Former Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel will not get reinstated. The feds place blame for the FIU bridge collapse, and there's new technology at Jackson Hospital that's keeping patients out of the emergency room. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Katie Swetolski, in for Tom Hudson. Florida senators debated for hours earlier this week, voting to side with Governor Ron DeSantis and keep Scott Israel out of office as Broward County's sheriff. Yet Broward County senators voted to let Israel have his job back. And the National Transportation Safety Board concluded this week there were failures at nearly every step of the process to build the FIU bridge that collapsed earlier this year and killed six people. How much did human error play a role? Plus, how an algorithm at Jackson Hospital is helping keep ER costs down and putting a new focus on preventative care. All of that on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. I'm Katie Swetolski, and welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out this week. Florida senators met in Tallahassee earlier for a rare Senate-only special session to decide Scott Israel's fate. Israel was the sheriff of Broward County during both the 2017 airport shooting in Fort Lauderdale and the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. It's his response to the Parkland school shooting and those deputies under him at the Broward Sheriff's Office that caused then brand new Governor Ron DeSantis to suspend Israel from office and replace him with a former Coral Springs Police Sergeant Gregory Toney. Well, this week, senators voted 25-15, largely along party lines, to permanently remove Israel from office instead of reinstating him to the job. Ryan Petty traveled to Tallahassee this week. He lost his daughter, Elena, in the Stoneman Douglas shooting. Here's a part of what he had to say to senators during public testimony at a special session on Monday.
The senseless murder of so many, including my 14-year-old daughter, Elena, tests the limits of faith and demands more endurance than I thought possible. We didn't understand the magnitude of the failures by law enforcement.
Ryan Petty also sits on the statewide public safety commission that's making policy and security recommendations for how to make schools safer. He joins us in studio. Welcome, Mr. Petty.
Hi, Katie.
And we also have with us from WABE in Atlanta, State Senator Perry Thurston Jr. Thurston is a Democrat representing parts of Broward County. Although he does not directly represent Parkland, he does represent neighboring Margate. Welcome, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Katie, and it's a pleasure to be here.
And so, Mr. Petty, I want to begin with you. As we mentioned, you gave an emotional testimony to the Senate Rules Committee earlier this week. What did you want to get across to senators the most before the entire Senate voted?
Well, first of all, it's 20 months since the massacre at MSD and the loss of my daughter, Elena. And it's still tough to talk about it. What I wanted the Senate to understand is that this was a systemic failure by multiple agencies. But at that moment, we were talking about the leadership or lack thereof of Scott Israel. And I wanted the Senate to understand the pain and anguish that the families have felt over the loss of our loved ones and the failures that unfortunately contributed to this tragedy. This was the most preventable school shooting in history. I'm convinced of that. Spending a year and a half now on the commission investigating it, there were multiple failures. Any one of those could have prevented this shooting from happening, and I wanted the Senate to understand that. I wanted them to understand not only the emotion, but the scope and depth of the failures. In this case, by BSO.
And how are you feeling about the Senate's conclusion? I think a lot has been said about that this is sort of a victory of sorts for the victims' families. Is that an accurate representation of what you guys have been trying to get at?
I've struggled to find a word. There's no joy in this. The closest approximation, and it's not an emotion, but it's accountability. We don't want this to happen to any other families across the country, in the state of Florida, and certainly in Broward County. Nothing we do will bring our children or our loved ones back. So the only thing we can do is serve as a warning and a voice for our children and our loved ones that don't have a voice to say, don't let this happen again. What's frustrating to me is that at Ground Zero, Broward County, we seem to not be willing to learn the lessons of MSD, while other parts of the state have welcomed the recommendations. The rest of the nation has welcomed those. We've had bipartisan support in Congress to pass new legislation. The president has worked with us. Broward County seems to not want to learn the lessons of the tragedy at MSD.
Well, I wanted to ask you, watching the final debate before the vote took place on Wednesday afternoon, there was a notable tension of sorts between Democratic senators, especially those representing Parkland, and the family members of the victims that were there. A lot of the speeches from Democrats began with some sort of iteration of, you know, I don't know how they do it, or, you know, if it were my child. And yet they still took a stance of voting to reinstate Scott Israel as Broward County's sheriff. So I just wanted to ask you, with that tension, you know, how can we improve upon this for future potential executive suspensions or this process? How did you feel about that tension?
I would say it this. I would answer your question this way. I guess never underestimate the mental gymnastics that a politician will go through to do what they want to do, to serve their self-interest. And that's what we saw there. I don't need to be patronized. What I want them to do is listen and learn and understand and then vote their conscience. We didn't convince every senator that this should, that they should uphold the governor's suspension. And that's okay. Many voted on conscience. But what I saw in that hearing room was disgusting behavior on the part of some of the senators, and they should be ashamed.
Well, Senator Thurston, I am going to bring you into this conversation because you were one of the 15 senators who did vote to ultimately, you know, in favor of giving Israel his job back. But I would love, can you walk us through your reasoning for your vote?
Absolutely, Katie. And I don't think that there's anybody who does not appreciate and empathize with the parents of Parkland children. I mean, to say that would be to say that they're not human. You know, we all have children, we have families, and no one wants to see anybody have to go through that. So, and that's what makes it so difficult, because you want to try to show the appropriate respect there, but at the same time, we want to address monumental, critical issues dealing with the disenfranchisement of 2 million people who reside in Broward County. Now, when you say walk you through, we just it's a point of looking at the evidence. The same thing that the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission did when they looked at the evidence. The same thing that Mr. Gutierrez, the chairman of the commission, did when he made his statement that the evidence didn't even come close to being being there to remove the sheriff. The same thing that Mr. Dudley Goodlett, who was appointed by those same northern representatives of the state, did when he looked at all 10 counts and said not one of them were proven.
I'm just going to jump in here for a second. Dudley Goodlett is a special master or an independent arbitrator to the Senate who prepared a special report and recommended last month that the governor's office had not done enough to prove the burden of proof, rather, on Scott Israel to lose his job.
That's correct, Katie. And we just looked at the evidence, and we also looked at the precedent that we're setting. I think you've looked at editors across the state that have looked at this and said this is, as Dudley said, unsustainable, that anyone who's over a large agency will not be able to be comfortable that they, too, might not be removed for the actions of a subordinate.
And, Senator, that was a reason that a lot of Democrats mentioned, I think, on the floor for voting for Israel's reinstatement. Is there a concern about future precedent of this vote, especially for other Florida sheriffs?
Without a doubt. I think that you heard President Lee, past President Lee, the senator, talk about the fact that three senators in his You know, some of these districts cover multiple counties, so they have more than one sheriff. Here in Broward County, we have one sheriff, but he's got three senators in his district who's indicated that to them. If you look at their comments made by Sheriff Gutierrez, who is the chairperson, look at his comments and what he said, and then just read the report. I read a portion of Mr. Goodlett's report into the record during my debate, and I think that it outlines it specifically what the issue is here, why there would be problems going forward with the ruling like this, and why his decision was the right decision.
Mr. Petty?
So, look, my response to that is, you know, a good friend of mine said, we run very little risk of holding of having too much accountability in government. We're not on a slippery slope here. I understand there were arguments being made about precedent, but it was those that were in support of retaining the sheriff were arguing process and procedure, not on the facts or the merits. If you look at the response between the difference in response between BSO and Coral Springs, it was very clear. BSO was unprepared. They were not well trained. They were not well equipped, and they had no sense of urgency. That is all due to the lack of focus on public safety by the sheriff, and that puts the entire community at risk. Parkland paid the price on February 14th, but this is an issue that impacts everyone in Broward County. And the reason we were up there advocating for his removal is we don't want to see any more public safety issues in Broward County.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski, speaking with Parkland Father Ryan Petty and State Senator Perry Thurston. Senator, I wanted to ask you this idea that potentially, as Scott Israel has appealed his suspension and removal through the Senate, the idea that he maybe did not have a fully fair process has come up quite a bit. In your thought, was this a fair appeals process for him?
I don't think so. I think that what we see is that the rules certainly need to be clarified. I think that when you're have that much power to go in and change the will of 2 million people just on a inadvisable campaign political promise, you should have specific rules. Once we have a general master, the evidence that's presented to him, that should be the evidence that's considered by the Senate when we're making our decision. If you look at the pretrial hearings that was held by Special Master Goodlett, you'll see that every opportunity was given. You know, some people are talking about the lawyers not doing their job in that hearing and not presenting a substantial case. But then you had a second lawyer that came in. And if you look at the questions of in the Rules Committee that we asked that second lawyer, he didn't present anything differently. The reason he didn't present anything different, Katie, is because the best evidence was presented by the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas report. And the chairman, the best evidence was all of the evidence and the trials and the time that the special master spent in reviewing and giving the lawyers an opportunity. They presented to the special master that which they had.
And Senator, you were one of the senators in the Rules Committee on Monday listening to more than 10 hours.
Hello, hello, hello.
Oh, can you hear us, Senator?
Well, I do hear you now. I don't know if you heard me, though.
Oh, we can hear you.
I think that I was saying hello because I think I dropped off for a second.
Well, you were one of the senators in the Rules Committee on Monday for more than 10 hours of presentations. Do you think you would have voted differently had you not been sitting in on those presentations?
Are you asking me, was there something in the presentation that changed my mind?
Yes.
There was nothing in the presentations that changed my mind. And as I indicated, and I think I may have dropped off, I specifically asked the lawyer, did he have anything in addition to what the first lawyer presented to Mr. Goodlett? And his answers were, other than a faulty affidavit, that he didn't have anything in addition. The reason he didn't have anything in addition to that was the best evidence that was there.
And Senator, another father of a Parkland victim, Fred Guttenberg, tweeted out a picture of you seemingly sleeping during the debate this week. While it's not uncommon for lawmakers to doze on the floor, do you have a response to the criticism?
That I absolutely was not dozing on the floor. One of the things that we do in the Florida legislature is our entire proceeding is recorded. And I've indicated to the newspaper that I think reprinted that they should go to the floridachannel.org and look at the actual session and look at that portion where they say that I'm dozing and look at before and after. What I think is that, you know, there were probably hundreds of pictures taken. You're talking about 1 second in a four-hour hearing. But look at the entire hearing. Look at my debate, my questions. And more importantly, you just indicated there was a 10-hour hearing before that. And that was on Monday, 10/21. That's available, too. We would ask that you look at the entire hearing and look at that portion which purports to be me dozing. This was a monumental decision. To think that I would not be taking it serious and listening to the entire thing is certainly without merit.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Petty, I'm going to switch back to you because you also sit on the state's MSD Public Safety Commission, as we've mentioned. And the commission's report was weighed pretty heavily by the Senate in this decision, and it did not specifically recommend to remove Sheriff Scott Israel. Was that something you talked about?
It was not. In fact, there was testimony in the hearing to that effect. I've gone back through the record. I find no evidence that we ever entertained that. I don't think that was the mission or scope of the MSD Commission. It was to investigate and point out the failures, which we did. Just a comment, on what Senator Thurston just said. You know, a picture's worth a thousand words, as they say. One other point I'll make, talking about our Broward delegation, in the weeks before, we reached out to them to let them know that we wanted them to uphold the suspension of Governor Israel. One of the members of the delegation had not yet read the MSD Commission report, if you can believe that. I certainly couldn't, and asked us for the Cliff Notes version. If in Broward County,
senator was that?
I'm not going to say their name, but one of them, so I assume it was more than one of them. I know one of them has read it because she sits next to me on the commission. But I will tell you that if our delegation couldn't have been bothered to even pay attention or read the MSD Commission report prior to a week or so before the hearing, they are not serving the public interest of the residents of Broward County.
Well, and I want to ask you, the commission has its second report that's anticipated to come out on November 1st. Do you feel that this report goes beyond the first report in scope, or is this more tweaking and modifying and seeing what worked from the first report?
Well, there's a little bit of both. So we've had to make some tweaks and fixes because there were some places in Florida that didn't understand the law or the recommendations from the first report. And so we've made some adjustments there to make sure that there's clarity. But we're also double-clicking in certain areas and looking for more detail and making recommendations there. I think we're looking at the interaction between the various entities that are in charge of public safety and education of our students, and how do they work together better. We're also looking at mental health, and I think that may be an area for even more exploration in 2020 because we're woefully underfunding mental health services for our juveniles and for adults in Florida, and we need to address it.
And I saw the commission, one of the recommendations is for the state to allocate more funding to mental health services, although the commission hasn't really specified a number. Do you think that's a piece of maybe future recommendations?
Well, I think that's something that we probably would leave to the Senate and to the House to figure out. I think our job is to point out the issue and then let them debate what to do about it and how much funding to provide.
And one last question for you. What do you take away the most from this report?
On this particular report, I think we continue to do the work to make sure that we learn the lessons of the tragedy at MSD and make sure that it never happens to another child in Florida, regardless of their where they live, their zip code, their race, what school they go to. That's our mission and our purpose.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Parkland Father and Safety Commissioner Ryan Petty and Broward Senator Perry Thurston. Thank you to you both, really.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, a federal transportation agency concludes a months-long investigation into the FIU bridge collapse. I'm Katie Switalski. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup, and we'll be right back. I'm Katie Switalski. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out this week. The National Transportation Safety Board, or the NTSB, held a hearing in Washington, D.C. this week about what led up to the collapse of the pedestrian bridge at Florida International University last year. The collapse of the bridge over Southwest 8th Street killed six people, including a student and a bridge worker. Several others were injured. The NTSB has been investigating the collapse for 19 months, and this week they concluded that as opposed to what was previously thought, there were flaws with the design to start with. Every party, from FIU to the Florida Department of Transportation to the team that designed and built the bridge, and those who inspected it, made errors. Dr. Robert Malloy is the director of the Office of Highway Safety at the NTSB. He looks at how human error plays a part in transportation accidents. He joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Malloy.
Thank you very much for having me on, Katie.
Let's start with this week's new conclusions. What was the significance of the hearing in D.C.?
Well, the significance is that we really detailed the errors that led to the collapse of the bridge and the tragedy. And it's so often the case when we have tragedies like this, it's usually not one event. We were able to document the errors in the design of the bridge itself that made it unable to withstand the weight of the bridge. We were able to discover that that review that looked at that design was really inadequate and done by a company that wasn't qualified to do that review. And then we really talked about the fact that even with those two errors, the collapse took place over time, with cracking happening, getting worse each day. And a number of the parties were aware of this cracking and decided to take no action to protect the public.
And there seems to have been issues, like you mentioned, at pretty much every step here of the designing, building, installing, inspecting. Was there one main error that led to the others?
Well, it all began with the decision on how to design the bottom of the member 11. The node there was under-designed, and we found two significant errors that led to that. One, that they'd miscalculated how much force that member would need to hold up, and they were off by approximately 46%.
And so paint a picture for us, for someone that doesn't understand how bridges really get made. What does that look like?
Yeah, so again, when you think of a bridge being made, you know, you can kind of think of a plank going across a little hill, and your goal is whatever's going to go across that plank is going to add weight to that plank. So the plank needs to support itself and the weight of whatever's going over it. And so you design it in such a way that it has a resistance or strength to hold all that up. And so what they had done is basically miscalculated the amount of weight that it would need to hold up. And that got compounded by a calculation error that led to a overestimation of how much it could hold up on the way they designed it. So both of those errors led to that area being under-designed.
So bad math.
Again, some bad math, choosing the wrong modifiers when calculating some of the forces involved. Also making some decisions. They did multiple computer models to look at the forces that would be involved in the bridge. One of them matched the models that we worked on post-collapse. But they chose not to use that model, and we were actually not able to determine why. But, you know, so it's both bad math and some determination errors.
And how is this different from a standard functional, the way a pedestrian bridge is supposed to get made?
Well, again, the way there are guidelines that are used. Florida DOT has guidelines. AASHTO, which is the American Association of State Highway Transportation officials, have guidelines that really tell you how to make a bridge. And you follow those guidelines. And then if you meet all those, again, the demands that the bridge are going to have, and you build the bridge sturdy enough to resist those demands, there's a reliability to that bridge that is going to ensure that bridge is going to stand through its lifetime.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski, and we're talking with Dr. Robert Malloy from the National Transportation Safety Board. Dr. Malloy, your background is in experimental psychology. Where do you see the human error in this case?
Well, I think one of the things is, particularly when it comes to responding to the cracking, is sometimes, you know, we're not willing to take difficult actions. We may choose an easier path, and it doesn't take much for us to do that. If someone assures us that that cracking is fine, which happened in this case multiple times, even though we had concerns, we may be willing to say, okay, we won't take the difficult choice to close the bridge down and close the traffic underneath it. And that's where the board found that, you know, all of the parties really had a role in this collapse, because they knew that the bridge was talking to them, that it had was having a hard time holding the weight, and it was evidenced in the cracking, but nobody took action. And when we talked to the parties, you know, they uniformly said, well, we were told it was safe, so we didn't take action. And sometimes we need to be able to go with our own feelings. These cracks were 40 times what's normally acceptable. And so they were clearly structural cracks. People knew that. They were documenting it, but they didn't take that final action of closing things down to make things safe.
And now, in the hearings this week, the NTSB has been very critical of all of the parties involved with this bridge collapse. Why didn't people who maybe saw the visible cracks, or, you know, they were told things were okay, is there a reason that they didn't speak up that we know of?
Well, we know, again, that a number of them spoke up. This is, you know, one of these curious things about the investigation is we do work through a party process. We had 13 different groups working with us on this investigation. And, you know, sometimes we do end up with people saying, hey, it wasn't my fault, it was the other group's fault. In this case, it really spread around to everyone because they were all aware of the issue. They brought it up repeatedly as being a concern. But then they kept dropping it when they were told it really wasn't a safety concern. And then the next day they would bring it up again. So it was an error that they were certainly concerned about to bring it up repeatedly. But when they were basically given the presentation that said the day of the collapse, we're going to make these changes, you know, to the bridge, we're not really sure why the cracking is happening, but don't worry, it's safe. And unfortunately, people decided, okay, I'm not going to go with what I feel. I'm going to go with just what we just talked about, and didn't make that difficult decision. And we've made recommendations for the FDOT, Florida DOT, to change how they do these contract arrangements to make it clear that all of these agencies have a responsibility and the authority to stop a project when they feel that safety is being compromised.
And it was the Tallahassee firm Fig Bridge Engineers that designed the bridge. Now, the NTSB cannot issue sanctions, but are you recommending any further action be taken against this Fig Bridge Engineers firm?
Well, the reality is we're not about finding who is to blame in an accident we investigate. We're about finding what happened, what went wrong, and what can be done to prevent this from the future. We certainly made two recommendations to FIG, Bridge Engineers, one to improve how they calculate the capacity for the bridge. Another is they had a design firm review their design, and they picked a design firm that was not qualified to do so. And so they need to do more vigilance in actually making sure the people who are working for them are qualified to do so. But our big concern is making sure the whole bridge community is aware of the errors that are made and changes are made to the documents that guide people on how to build these bridges. So we've made recommendations to the Federal Highway Administration and, as I said before, ASHO, to change those design manuals to make sure that people are calculating the forces correctly, that when people do an independent review, they review the connections. And that was critical in this case. So it's some improvements for FIG, but also improvements for the whole industry.
And we know that a full report from the NTSB about the hearing this week is due out in a couple of weeks. Quickly, do you know what that report will include?
So the reality is the materials that we've made available already, the findings and the probable cause and the recommendations, that's the meat of the report. The supporting materials that build us to those conclusions and to those recommendations and that probable cause,
thank you,
that
Doctor.
Will be added.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but we've been speaking with Robert Malloy from the National Transportation Safety Board. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still to come, an algorithm at Jackson Hospital decreasing ER costs. I'm Katie Switalski. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Jackson Hospital is using a computer code to manage how some patients access health care. The hospital is specifically targeting visits to the ER. It built a custom algorithm to reduce unnecessary visits, as well as save a lot in taxpayer money. We want to hear from you. What's your emergency room experience? What can be done better at hospitals like Jackson? Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to the number 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. Joining us now to talk about the program is Miami Herald healthcare reporter Ben Konark. And we're also joined by Stephanie Schmidt. She's director of population health management at Jackson.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
And I want to start, Stephanie, before we get into the technology, how does the program work healthcare-wise?
So the intent of the program is to look at those individuals that have had a high history of using the emergency department versus going to primary care. So our intent is to reduce the ones in the ER that do not need to be there. We recognize that there are folks that have a lot of chronicity and will, in fact, need emergency department care. But these are folks that need to be transitioned, as the title of the program is ED care transition, to primary care so that they have regular, ongoing care that includes preventive care versus episodic care in the emergency department.
And Jackson's IT department came up with this algorithm, a computer code to identify certain patients. And what kind of indicators, or what was the algorithm looking for? Are these people refilling a prescription at the ER?
So these people that meet criteria to be on what we deem to be our top 100 list is these are unfunded patients, therefore they have no insurance. They have had 5 or more emergency department visits in the last year. They have multiple chronic conditions. They do not have a primary care physician, and these folks are all being highly subsidized by Jackson. Yes, as you mentioned, they come into the emergency department for things that are really not appropriate for that area, meaning medication refills, to have a wound check. And some of them are doing this not really knowing any better. They have not been directed to take on a different path of care.
And so the system helps the hospital, but how does the code help patients manage their care?
So this 100 top list is refreshed daily, and it comes to me. And from that, it is a risk stratification where the patients are prioritized. I can see by that list if any of them are currently hospitalized and a number of other demographic and other data factors on them. And then I assign them to a population health specialist to the patient as a case manager. And that individual reviews their medical record, begins to contact the patient and try to get the patient to be amenable to be a participant in the program.
And so when it comes to these case managers, how involved are they in patients' lives?
So the first thing that they have to do is to contact the patient. And for some, they're not easy to contact. They either don't want to be contacted or they don't know the nature of the caller. Once they contact the patient, the next goal is to engage them and get them to trust the case manager and to begin to communicate to them, you know, why they haven't been going to care, what they perceive some of their needs to be. And from that, what we initially start to unfold is that these folks have significant social needs, and that is serving as a barrier to them getting care.
And so we're talking with Stephanie Schmidt from Jackson Hospital, and also in studio with us is Miami Herald's healthcare reporter, Ben Konark. Ben, healthcare is inherently expensive.
Right.
So how does this program aim to reduce the costs as well, specifically at a hospital like Jackson that's a safety net for the whole community?
Yeah, exactly. So obviously at the Miami Herald, we're very interested in Jackson because it's taxpayer supported, and part of our mission is to inform our readers what their tax money is being spent on. This program, as we wrote in the article, it evaluates the average cost of an emergency department visit at around $2,100, which is pretty significant. So it really manages costs by preventing those visits, right? So if you can get someone to go see a primary care physician on a regular basis, the idea is that you address their health issues before it reaches that point of a crisis where then they have, let's say they develop diabetes or obesity or some condition like that, when they're going to be much more expensive to treat. So it's really about preventative care, and that's how they bring those costs down.
Is the idea behind these case managers to connect patients that are going to the ER for non-really ER services to get them to primary care?
Yeah, I mean, when I first spoke to Stephanie, you know, she mentioned that people were showing up to the emergency department for things as simple as a prescription refill. So it's really, you're talking about people, given the demographics of the population, you're talking about people who don't really have a good idea of how to access their healthcare system, right? So they're going for things like prescription refills. You know, they might have other issues in their lives that are preventing them from seeing a doctor on a regular basis. They probably don't have insurance if they've been identified by this algorithm. So it's really about instilling good habits. You know, I think Stephanie described it pretty early on to me as behavior modification, right? You're taking someone who doesn't have good habits around their managing their healthcare, and you're trying to teach them, okay, so, you know, can you make it to this appointment? Do you need help getting there? Can we go with you? And then maybe they'll sit in on the appointment and they'll advocate for that patient. Maybe they're going to ask the doctor questions that the patient probably should be asking, but doesn't have the wherewithal to ask on their own. So it's really, you know, and we're seeing this across the healthcare industry. For instance, in Medicare Advantage, it has some of this too. It's this idea of high touch care. The more you see a doctor, the less likely you are to have major health issues. So that it folds into this as well. And the idea that if we can get some of our most vulnerable people in Miami to see a doctor more often, it's going to lower the cost of care, kind of counterintuitively, because you're thinking more doctor's visits would mean more expenses for the healthcare system, especially if they're uninsured. But the idea is, this high-touch method, you're doing more of preventative care, so it's a lower cost. Just seeing a doctor, getting your prescriptions, making sure you're monitoring your blood pressure, making sure you're eating a healthier diet, those kind of things to prevent those high-cost treatments.
And I'm going to ask you about insurance in just a minute, but
sure.
We want to hear from our listeners, what's your ER experience been like? You can give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text with your experience to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. And now, Ben, this program right now does focus mostly on uninsured patients. How could that serve a more commercial purpose for people with insurance?
Sure. So that's kind of what I was hinting at earlier. So there's, for instance, the Trump administration has really thrown its weight behind Medicare Advantage. And there's a debate happening right now about, you know, these private providers who are then taking on Medicare clients, right? So part of that idea is, you know, what are you incentivizing? What behaviors are you incentivizing? The way Medicare currently works, it's fee-for-service. So you go in there, you get a lab test done, and the doctor is reimbursed for every service that you get. And with Medicare Advantage, they're using different metrics, for instance, you know, health-focused metrics. So You know, that's not an endorsement of Medicare Advantage, because obviously there are still issues that people are working out. But this, we are seeing this kind of shift in the healthcare industry towards thinking about preventative care as a point of focus rather than just treating kind of on a reactionary basis.
And Stephanie, how many patients has the program served so far? It's been around for a couple of years. Is that right?
It's been around for 2 years. We have screened and provided intervention to 1,800 patients. And some of those interventions are of low intensity and others are of high intensity. And those that actually consent to participate in the program are deemed to be in intensive case management.
What is low intensity versus high intensity?
So low intensity is that when we get the patient on our list, some of their more critical issues may have already passed, but they still have needs that they need to access care, get assistance with appointments, get assistance with their medications, get connected to some community service resources, and we can accomplish that without them really needing to be in our program long term. So some people do have fewer needs than others. But those that are deemed to be participants in the program, they end up in our program on the average working specifically with one case manager who is the population health specialist for approximately 6 months. So we get to know them very well.
And if you can explain, how is it more cost effective for Jackson Hospital to hire case managers and get people to more doctor's appointments instead of the ER?
So we're working on case management from an outpatient perspective, and I think our role is largely around linkage. We are linking patients, for example, when they're in the hospital to the primary care site afterwards. We're linking patients to community resources. If patients have providers in the community like a federally qualified health center like Camillus or Miami Rescue Mission, we don't want to break that established relationship. So we're co-managing the patients with those providers and working directly with them. So
if a patient is seeing a case manager for roughly 6 months, is there any case manager burnout? I mean, it sounds like for some of these high intensity needs.
I would not call it burnout, but it does take a very special person because these case managers are on call and available to these patients 24/7. And they serve to be facilitative, educative, and very supportive. Some of these people really just need a lot of hope. So we're serving in that capacity. And yes, it does take someone that has the ability really to work across all medical conditions, to understand the social needs, and to really understand the resources that are available in Miami-Dade County.
And this program really started all from a computer coding program. What's next for this? Are there plans to expand?
So the other thing that Jackson did through the IT department is they built an actual platform for us in which this high utilizer list comes through, but it also serves as our avenue for the case managers to document all the interventions and all the communications with patients, because they text them, they email, they do face-to-face. There's all kinds of ways that they're connecting. So it's very high touch and high connectivity. And so, yes, the platform and this algorithm now allows the program to be scalable, to be very condition-specific. It can be a population at large. There's many ways that this can go, and we want to do this clearly working hand in hand with Jackson's strategic plan and what we can do to make the healthcare more better for the community.
And Ben, I want to come back to you before we wrap up. There's another story about Jackson Hospital that you covered this week. You reported that U.S. Health and Human Services has fined the hospital over $2 million over stolen and lost patient records. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, so this was an investigation that HHS's Office of Civil Rights had been conducting for some time that related to different breaches of patient privacy information. You know, there were different examples. There were lost boxes of records from the emergency room. There was an issue with an NFL player who was being treated there for a fireworks-related injury, which then his medical information was leaked to a reporter by an employee at Jackson. So that was part of this investigation. And then there was another employee who was found to be improperly accessing records and selling them for the purposes of identity theft. So the federal government led this investigation. They looked at it pretty exhaustively, and what they found was that Jackson was having a lot of issues with, having policies and procedures that would prevent this kind of privacy breaches. So,
And these were situations like an employee leaking information to an ESPN reporter.
Correct.
Another selling records. Both of these are illegal.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, it is unclear at this point if there will be criminal charges. I mean, the notice that HHS sent to Jackson said that, you know, they sanctioned these employees by terminating them, but they were kind of hitting Jackson for not doing enough to safeguard against stuff like this happening. Now, obviously, Jackson had a response to that. They said, we are focusing on this. We want to improve. They conceded that their past performance in this did not live up to their standards and that they were working to implement new technologies and new policies to prevent these kind of breaches from the future. But this is also an issue that we've seen come up at other institutions as well. There is a lot of concern as we live in an era of technology, electronic medical records, a lot of people putting a lot of sensitive information in these systems. And we live in an era where cybersecurity is top of mind for everyone from the federal government on down. So, these issues do come up from time to time, and it's a concern for patients that their personal information could get leaked to, you know, any kind of wrongdoer.
Well, what can hospitals do to better protect all of this patient data that's floating around?
That's a great question that I don't really know the answer to because it's not my line of expertise. But I mean, I think that's something that Jackson's probably looking at really carefully, and I plan to follow up on with them about kind of what they're doing to prevent this kind of stuff from happening in the future.
And Stephanie, I wanted to ask you, when it comes to the program and the algorithm that is reducing unnecessary ER visits and focusing on preventative care, that data from the computer algorithm, is that something there was patient consent to? How does that patient data work?
So the patients that are in our program have all been serviced by Jackson, and they have provided consent for treatment, and they do understand that it needs to be shared across the healthcare team in order for it to be effective. And one of the things we are doing, as I mentioned, is linkage to the healthcare team, whether it's internally or externally. So there is some data sharing that's required, and we are very careful about that. We do not, even when we go with a patient, let's say, to an appointment and we accompany the patient into the actual appointment room, we do get that patient's consent. So we're careful, and everybody is screened before they get access to any records at Jackson with regard to education, and there are audits performed.
And how is Jackson really looking at cybersecurity? As Ben mentioned, more and more patient data is being collected by big hospitals like Jackson.
So I'm gonna respond to that as an employee, and what I as an employee and what I as a director see there. As I mentioned, there are very rigid requirements for training and retraining. There are strong compliance practices now. Some of the things that were mentioned in the article that Ben just responded to are not recent. They go back to 2013. There's been many changes in practices and requirements implemented since there. Obviously, we all want to learn from lessons, correct? So it is very closely monitored, and there are security officers, there's compliance officers, there are IT administrators that are looking across different segments of the data, whether it's clinical data, whether it's eligibility data, people that are working with claims. So it's very segmented, and there is strong IT security oversight over all that data.
And Ben, when it comes to an algorithm program like this, where do you see it going? Did you get a chance to talk to any of the patients that have been through it?
No, we did request that, but you know, it's actually a good transition for something I wanted to bring up that I found really interesting about this program is part of the difficulty with Jackson, and they did try. They tried to connect us with the patient, but this population is very vulnerable, right? So some of the statistics they gave us that, you know, when they looked at when they first started the pilot, they looked at the 2 years prior who had been what they call high utilizers of the emergency department, and they found that at least 28% of them had experienced homelessness. About 49% had a diagnosis related to mental or behavioral health disorders, and about 25% had diagnosis of schizophrenia or other delusional disorders. So you're really talking about some of the hardest to manage patients that Jackson sees. Yeah, so go ahead.
No, thank you, Ben. We've been speaking with Ben Konark from the Miami Herald and Stephanie Schmidt from Jackson Hospital. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Finally on the roundup, tens of thousands of people have been in Key West this week for the annual Fantasy Fest.
Tabor and Laverne the Silky Chicken.
Tabor and Laverne the Silky Chicken, they're the third place winners in the kids division of the Pet Masquerade. That's a costume contest for kids, adults, and their pets. First place in the kids division went to Lucas and the 101 Dalmatians.
101 Dalmatians!
All right, with little Lucas!
There were actually just about 25 kids, all of whom were children, nieces, and nephews of Key West firefighters. Fantasy Fest ends this Sunday. The event turned 40 years old this year. Our Florida Keys reporter, Nancy Klingener, interviewed one of the founding fathers of Fantasy Fest. You can find it at WLRN.org. And WLRN has also recently launched a Florida Keys newsletter. Keep track of all of the most important news from the island chain. You can find more details on how to subscribe on our Facebook page, the South Florida Roundup. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Leppery. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. And WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zapka. The show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Katie Swatowski, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. Thank you for calling and listening. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.